allegory has a way of clarifying the most essential truths of a story.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with novelist Dave Eggers about his book, The Captain and the Glory, part fable, part satire, part allegory.
And that's the sort of advantages, I guess, of allegory, is that you can take it to its logical extreme and see it at a scale that's sort of understandable.
The Glory, Dave Eggers, and Writing with a Bite on Arts and Letters.
You could go at it alone. Maybe turn off the phone. We've got the time. If it's everything else you want, I'll sell it and buy a new one for half.
Imagine that you are about to embark on a journey on a glorious cruise ship whose captain, gray at the temples now, who had steered the great ship Glory for many years, was ready to retire. And some of the passengers of the ship decide it's time for a change, to shake things up. And they elect a new captain who has no experience, who has formerly sold souvenirs on the putt-putt course, doesn't understand the first thing about ships, and has no love loss for those who have elected him.
When effort and failure collides, in the end I hope you find a place open wide.
Dave Eggers, the captain in the glory, welcome to Arts and Letters.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You kind of talk about a story dictating the form and then the form arriving with you. How did this form kind of arrive in your head?
You know, I've been covering Trump as a journalist since August of 2016. It was the first time I went to a Trump rally. And every time I would write something, even when it was kind of reflective of the surreality of the time and the high comedy of so many aspects of the era, and also the horror too, because I've been covering immigration issues and the effects of Trump's policies on asylum seekers. And I would finish a piece and look at it, and it was always sort of a little bit more sober-minded and measured and rational than really what was happening in a way. I mean, I was taking very small slices of the effects of Trump's policies, but I didn't feel like I was capturing the madness of the era. And so not to denigrate those other, the journalistic pieces I did, but I kind of kept thinking that there was a place for allegory, parable, satire, some sort of blending of the three to sort of back up and tell the story and try to reflect the bewildering, unprecedented, far beyond fictional surrealness of the time. And when I placed it all on a, you know, instead of a country, it's a ship, and instead of a population of 320 million, it's a group of a few thousand on a ship and in a contained space, and they're electing a new captain. And instead of choosing a captain among all of the experienced first mates and navigators and engineers, they choose the one person on the ship who sells souvenirs at the putt-putt golf course and has never captained a ship and doesn't even like ships. And so setting it in this other spot and with its own set of rules, leaving D.C., it kind of gave me a freedom to operate and to heighten the plot a bit and to put things in starker relief, I guess, and to limit the cast a bit. And it was really liberating. And I feel like at the end, it reflected that sense that we all have that we're in some irrational funhouse mirror of a moment.
"I like being captain," said the man with the yellow feather. He was installed high on the bridge of the Glory and surveyed the seas with swelling pride. The ship's passengers had elected him to steer the ship, and he was very pleased about it. The supporters of the new captain were pleased, too. In fact, they were jubilant. Never in their lifetimes had something like this happened. They felt triumphant and unstoppable and capable of anything.
"Leave your worries on the shore. You don't need
land anymore. We've got a boat. Get on the boat.
To celebrate the unprecedented victory, they planned a parade to honor the new captain, to be held later that day. While some supporters were festooning the ship with bunting and balloons, a group of the captain's most ardent fans, too excited to be effective decorators, instead found a pair of passengers who had supported the previous captain, and they beat him with clubs and hammers, thinking joyfully of the new captain with every blow. While they beat their opposition, they got word that the admiral had just died.
North or south, we can go, it's not the open road, but it sure flows, we've got a boat.
So shocked and disappointed was he in the ascendance of the glory's worst passenger that his head froze and his heart burst simultaneously, causing the rest of his body to give up too. This news, though sad for many, was very satisfying to the most fervent supporters of the man with the yellow feather. It made them feel not just triumphant, but liberated too, free from history, free from all that was staid and stuffy and stale. And yet there was something that nagged at these supporters of the man with the yellow feather. When the little girl had given her speech, in which she called the new captain, and by inference his supporters, most foul, it had stung. In fact, it really hurt.
I've been listening to this debate, and I have to say that I am flabbergasted that this idea is even being entertained. There's no way a rational group of adults would ever give such power to a man like this, over our very lives. A man who has absolutely no relevant experience, who has never sailed even a dinghy. A man known only for a crude mouth and a yellow feather. Give yourself some credit. We are a noble people with a storied history. We deserve to be led by the most enlightened, reasonable, and honorable among us, not the loudest, cruelest, most selfish, and most foul.
But then a few of the captain's most besotted supporters had an idea, and the idea was to own it. In preparation for the parade, they attached to their clothing thousands of chicken feathers and fashioned beaks with paper plates. On their chest, they wrote the words, most foul, and they strutted about the ship, much to the delight of the captain's other supporters. The upskirt boys considered them daffy and grotesque, but they said nothing, hoping the feathered nonsense would catch on. It did.
North or south, we can go, it's not the open road, but it sure flows, we've got a boat.
This is a satire, or maybe an allegory. Could you just kind of tell our listeners the differences between satire and allegory? I think of satire as writing with a bite, and allegorical to be kind of loosely related to the thing that is.
An allegory is telling a story about a time, but telling it with an alternate set of rules and characters, like, you know, Orwell's Animal Farm would be maybe the perfect example of talking about economic systems, capitalism versus socialism, but through the lens of a barnyard and its animals and this, you know, pecking order that reigns there. And so that was and always has been an inspiration to me because it's so economical. Allegory has a way of clarifying the most essential truths of a story. And a satire you could almost see set in D.C. with a very similar set of characters, an actual president named Trump, et cetera. And I'm not sure how much we would learn or how much it would differ from what we're seeing in the news. But when I settled on the idea of moving this all to a ship, and a cruise ship like this is inherently kind of comical and silly, and the uniforms that everybody has to wear and the pool and the shuffleboard and the Lido deck and all of these things that I only really know from The Love Boat has a sort of built-in comedy to it that was really appealing, and I kept on exploring that. But because it is sort of commenting on our time during our time, you know, that's what satire typically does. And so we expect a little bit more distance and timelessness, I guess, from an allegory or a parable. I don't know which one it is, and I decided not to settle on one or the other. In short order, dozens more supporters created their own most foul costumes, some of them using the aviary spelling of the word, each of them choosing to dress as whatever bird reflected their personality. And thus, when the parade began and the captain was carried on a litter through the crowds, he saw his supporters costumed as hens and roosters, road runners and condors, chickadees and cockatoos. They held signs that read, "A Captain Most Foul," and they cheered the new captain with abandon. When the captain came near, they tried to touch him, but he recoiled, because he considered them filthy simpletons who carried unnameable and uncountable contagions and germs. Otherwise, though, it was a wonderful parade, and the new captain wished it could last forever. The idea of standing on the bridge, navigating and steering all day, held less appeal than being cheered by people dressed in handmade avian costumes. At the end of the parade, he was carried to the bridge, where he met the eyes of a dozen crew members there to assist him, none of whom he trusted. He looked at all the screens and levers and buttons, and he whistled. "There sure are a lot of screens and buttons here." He whistled again. "This is already more complicated than I thought," he thought.
We can see so many of the obvious illusions here, but I was wondering if you'd talk about some of the not-so-obvious illusions, or at least not as obvious to me. So the man in the vent?
Yeah.
I think that's very interesting, this man who's kind of down in the bowels of the ship, or a voice at one point, and whispering all kinds of things to the captain, who feels so alone and kind of disembodied from everybody. He lays on the floor. He listens to this guy in the vent who tells him to do ridiculous and horrible things.
Psst. And so, because the captain was awake and had nothing else to do, he listened closely over the next few hours as the voice in the vent said a great many fascinating things.
"No captain has ever done more for the ship than you."
So many things that the captain had suspected but had never felt the courage to say. The voice in the vent advanced a quite rational theory that it was actually 297 years earlier than commonly believed.
"It is actually 297 years earlier than is commonly believed."
And this was the fault of Pope Sylvester.
"A very bad guy."
Psst. He explained that certain sandwiches were not good.
"Not good."
He explained that the historic adversaries of the Glory, various pirate crews who plagued the seas, looting and beheading innocents, were in fact admirable go-getters that the captain would be wise to work with on various initiatives.
"They are admirable go-getters."
He lucidly explained that the crew members who worked in the engine room were plotting against the captain, and he said that the ship would be better if certain people, who looked a certain way and were from certain places,
were to be thrown overboard.
The captain listened, rapt,
as the voice in the vent went on, listing the many things that were to fear and hate and the various ways the world not under the bed was terrifying and perilous.
Terrifying and perilous.
The captain felt at last that someone was expressing his innermost thoughts.
And this is the fault of Pope Sylvester.
Like the voice in the vent, the captain loathed most people and suspected that beneath every simple seeming truth, there was a sinister lie. Like the voice in the vent, the captain was angry and bewildered by so many things. Salad, for starters, and also dictionaries, and ranch houses.
And mustaches, of course.
And women not wearing bathing suits.
Where did the man in the vent come from?
At first, he was really a combination of all of the conspiracy theorists that Trump listens to and echoes and sometimes retweets, and to whom he goes for his most trusted information.
Psst.
The voice in the vent was angry and bewildered by all these things too, and had very brilliant theories about these fearful factors.
Strengthening the security around the bridge is imperative.
How they were connected in a coordinated way designed to undermine the captain and make the ship less good.
Less good.
As the voice in the vent continued, the captain felt himself growing stronger. He felt, as the voice talked through the night, that he had made a true friend, an advocate, an ally, a North Star.
This will have the added benefit of keeping out snakes with esophageal cancer. Highly communicable.
The captain is hiding under his bed, as he does every night. And he listens to this voice in the vent, and they find each other, and they have this very creepy symbiotic relationship where the captain feels heard and validated and enlightened by this voice, and the voice feels like he has somebody who can exist in the world and act on his theories and fears.
No captain has ever done more for the ship than you.
Late in the book, just for your listeners, I'm revealing what is sort of revealed at the end, where, you know, at the very end when things are falling apart on the ship, we encounter this very lonely, friendless, terrified person at the bottom of the vent who's been whispering in the captain's ear all along.
He had a vast plain of sickly forehead, and his black turf of hair was rapidly retreating. He looked like the kind of man who might have gone to Santa Monica High School, who might have been excluded once or twice in that large, diverse school, and who, trying one last time to win their approval, might have run for class president and might have lost badly, and who might, thereafter, have vowed to take revenge on all those who denied him office. The liberal, the humorous, the nuanced, and non-white.
And so I wanted the captain to be not the sort of courageous authoritarian that I think a lot of his supporters see in him, but more a very afraid, a very lonely, isolated, and needy person who is
afraid of everything.
Afraid of everything and desperate for just a little bit of approval, I guess, and connection, but really unhealable in a way.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. We're talking with writer Dave Eggers about his book, The Captain and the Glory. I'm just interested in the absurdist elements.
Yeah, you know, at the same time, what's funny is that the captain recruits, or in this story, transforms all of the aides and ship hands and, you know, assistants and the people on a cruise ship that would be getting deck chairs and towels and serving margaritas. He transforms them into a sort of a shadow army or a militia that does his bidding, and they come to be known as the Snowmen. Finally, there were the passengers who chose to fight the captain and the upskirt boys. And they did so whenever they could. They called themselves the Kindly Mutineers, for they were determined not to stoop to the base level of the captain and the snowmen and the most foul. Instead, they rebelled politely, with properly filled out complaint forms and sternly worded memos. When these forms and memos had no effect,
The captain had the snowmen burn them each night upon a pyre around which the feathered most fowl danced. The kindly mutineers then filed injunctions and passed resolutions. When these injunctions and resolutions had no effect, they looked in the few remaining ship's manuals, which contained the ship's laws and regulations, to see if the captain had violated any of them. Very quickly, they realized that the captain had violated many hundreds of these laws and regulations, had in fact violated all but a few of them with astonishing speed and thoroughness. Having realized this, though, the kindly mutineers were unsure what step to take next. It seemed very drastic to unseat the captain, and to be sure, trying to unseat him carried with it the risk of failure, given the fact that he had many supporters dressed as birds.
I just think it's funny you call them kindly mutineers because you can't have, you really can't have both.
They really, the Democrats were for so long, they were so measured in everything they did, no matter what new outrage there was, that was just unconscionable actions and unprecedented anti-democratic behavior and disrespect for allies, treaties, precedent, law, everything. They still maintain this very sort of polite, plodding, and measured way of talking about it, which I do respect, but I thought I would reflect it with these sort of very polite mutineers.
One last thing I think we'll just talk about. There is a moment that comes where there's a rebuilding. There's a rethinking, and they go back to original documents. They go back to, in this case, the ship's manual, which wasn't really just a manual.
In such a hurry we go.
It was an opportunity to kind of put out a way of being in the world on the seas, a kind of manifesto, I guess.
Only a time to grow old.
Maybe a declaration is better said. And they come around to understanding that they've lost their way and there are principles that they can reinvoke. Do you feel that's possible?
Yeah, I think it's inevitable. I mean, we are a nation of laws. And every time that Trump has tried to subvert them, he has been slowed down, if not stopped. I mean, we do have very effective courts. We do have a really brilliant system of checks and balances that I think has been generally working. So that I think that it all works as well as it can and as well as anybody else has ever made a government work, really. It's like Churchill said, you know, democracy is the worst form of government in the world, but it's better than everything else, something like that. And so I do really believe that we have a moment right now where people, I think that he has a surprising amount of people that would follow him if he decided to tear up much of the Constitution. Because I think that a surprising amount of the electorate really does think it's about the human. It's about the president. The president is a king, even if temporary.
Got motivation when there's a will.
It is disappointing to see how many people don't know what it means to be a nation of laws and not humans, not kings, because I don't think it's something that everybody recognizes and lives with every day. But I do think we will be restored to some state of democratic grace. We will get back to our previous and better selves, and the next candidates on both sides will be inevitably more respectful, knowledgeable, and humble before our history and our laws.
To make a little sense of anything.
Look!
Said Ava one day. She pointed to a series of tiny vessels approaching the ship. They were the kind of pitiful rafts and junks and dinghies that the captain and his snowmen had blown from the water, had cannoned and sunk. But though the Glory's passengers had forgotten just about everything of their history, a precious few of them remembered that at one point they had had compassion for people like this, those approaching by boat with nothing, 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 nothing. And so they lowered ropes and ladders and made ready to welcome those who had drifted to them while they too were drifting. But when the vessels got closer and the people aboard became clearer, the ship's passengers saw that they were not coming empty-handed. They had no food and they had little water, but in each of these tiny vessels, there were the distinctive orange-covered books that had once lined the bridge of the Glory.
"We found these in the sea,"
said the first of the boat people who climbed aboard the ship.
"A steady string of them."
This woman was ragged and underfed and tired, but her smile was wide and she was very happy to be aboard the large and sturdy ship about which she'd heard so much for so long. She explained that her boat had encountered a few of the orange-clad books hundreds of miles away, and that the steady string of them had led her boat and others, like breadcrumbs, to the Glory. She and the others in her boat knew these books, were familiar with the sober and soaring words within, and knew them to be the words of a noble people who believed in these words, these precepts, more than they believed in the despots and charlatans and strongmen who bent so many other countries to their will and whim.
"We figured you'd want these back,"
the woman said. And just then a young man arrived, her son, and he had another of the books of the Glory. A girl, only 7, followed, and she too carried one of the manuals. She was lifted aboard, and dozens more came aboard from this first woeful vessel and from many more that followed, each of them carrying these books of laws and ideals, and in their presence and in their gifts, the storm-tossed humans looking for a ship in which to survive the seas provided some hope that the Glory might know again the meaning of its name.
"We figured you'd want these back."
"You could go at it alone. Maybe turn off the phone. We've got the time."
Thank you. And it just, it does remind you so much of, you know, people on boats coming and seeing the possibility of a shining city on the hill.
Yeah, as close as anyone has or could come. We're not perfect, but I do think we've gotten as close as anybody else. And I think that we will get closer still.
We deserve to be led by the most enlightened, reasonable, and honorable among us.
Well, space might increase in between. You'll never be farther from me. We'll
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thank you for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to actors Adam Simon, Jenny Mitchell, and Paige Wells as Ava. Thank you to musician Phil Davis.
When effort and failure collides, in the end I hope you find a place so dim wide.
And the band Sea Nanners for such marvelous soundscapes.
I don't know what's wrong. And darling, I don't know what's going on.
Thank you to Adam Simon. Simon Sound for mastering the program. Thank you to writer Dave Eggers for your allegorical novel. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of George Orwell. The best books are those that tell you what you already know.